Good evening, everyone. Thank you so much for coming out tonight. I'd like to welcome Kira Pykrath for her first, I think it's your first visit to the Poison Pen. Yeah. And maybe if I move the shrubbery, I will see you better. I'd really like to thank Pen Women who have been meeting here on this date, in this particular week in March, for how many years now? 24. Oh, really long time. And I want to thank them for these beautiful flowers that just happen to sort of match the cover of Baby X. So how clever is that? So welcome, all of you. It's lovely to see you again. We're very excited to introduce Kira to you. And I would like to say that I did say to her, if she hadn't been coming to do this event, I might not have been able to find time to read her book, since if you're reading our newsletter, well, you will realize that there are almost 300 new adult novels publishing every week, and I do my best, but I just can't keep up. But when we have events and when we do book clubs and all, I always read those because I can't recommend a book to you that I haven't actually read. And I fell in love with Kira's book for a great many reasons, and I thought we might start by talking about her background and why it is she chose to write a book that is set just slightly in the future. In fact, the science is already there, but it hasn't progressed enough to be readily available. So why don't you introduce yourself?
Sure. So thank you so much, everyone, for coming out to see me. This is my first time in Scottsdale, and it's really a delightful place. So, and thank you so much for having me here. It's an honor to be at this store. I've heard of it, of course, and always looked up to you for doing the work you do. So I'm really honored to be here.
Well, it's really our pleasure. So now that we are mutually admiration, let's carry on to be all about you.
So I am a former journalist, and I have a graduate degree in a field called bioethics, which, raise your hand if you've heard of this field before. Oh, okay, a lot of people have. Very good. I had not heard about it before I went to graduate school. I actually discovered it because I have always had a fascination with new science and technology, and not so much the nitty-gritty itself. Like, I'm not someone who wants to go be a lab technician or a biologist, but I'm very interested in how new science stands to affect our lives, our health, our longevity, and the way we live and the choices we make. That is super interesting to me. So this is my fifth book, and all my books deal in some way with some up-and-coming new breakthrough that has a lot of roots in reality, but I like to take things a little step further than where they are today and look ahead to where things might be going. So that's what I've done with this book. It centers around a medical breakthrough, which, as Barbara referred to, has already progressed quite a bit in mice, which, as you know, are the first step to getting something into humans. So this breakthrough is called IVG. It's known as the next generation of IVF in the assisted reproduction space. So I'm sure all of you know IVF requires invasive egg harvesting of a woman's eggs and creates embryos through sperm in a lab that then people can have implanted. And that's very common today. It dates back to 1978. It was done in secret back at that time, which I find fascinating because people are always worried when new technology is coming out. It's very scary, it's very controversial, and it's weird and it's different. So I love to talk about IVF before I get to the book itself, because it's very relevant. The two doctors that first did it in the UK had to do it in secret because they were so concerned about a backlash to test tube babies. And does anyone know what happened to those two doctors? Did they get arrested or go into hiding or get recognized in some meaningful way? Does anybody know? So none of those bad things actually happened to them. Many years later, they won the Nobel Prize for what they did. But it took at least, I think it was close to 20 years later before they were recognized. And today we have over 100,000 babies born that way every year. It's very normal. And I don't think any of us would be scandalized by that today. So that's kind of the backstory to where we're going with this book, which is, there's a new way now that's even better, even easier, even safer, and less invasive. And in this new way, people can any two people can have a baby just by giving a sample of their cells. Just a cheek swab will do it. Or any cell. You could pluck a hair with the root. I sneeze and there's some mucus in it. Saliva. If I leave saliva on my bottle, there's some DNA on it. And this small tiny bit of your cells and your DNA can be turned into a sperm or an egg with this technology. So I'll pause there.
Well, I told her I was when I read this book, I thought this was like Elon Musk, who we know has multiple children. He had actual sex, but it could have been done this way. And the reason I say that is because who is the most at risk of people casually harvesting their DNA? It's going to be celebrities, right? It's going to be billionaires. It's going to be that kind of thing. It's a different way of stalking, if you really think about it. Any of you who've seen, you know, groupies at athletic events or whatever, think about Swifties. If there was, at that concert, if her DNA was floating out there while she was singing, how many Swift babies could there actually have been? No, I mean, seriously, think about it. You know, it is. And so Kira has created what I think is one of the most interesting characters with an interesting job.
So my main character is a biosecurity guard, which is a profession I created for the book. And her job is to protect celebrities from DNA theft, from casual taking of someone's abandoned, you know, bottle or fork or hair they dropped or whatever. And regular people like us, we're not going to be aware of all of the DNA that we're leaving behind when we are out in public, but it happens all the time. I mean, we're constantly shedding DNA. And so this woman, the main character, one of the main characters, is brought on to tail a famous pop singer. So think of it like a male Taylor Swift. He's like a big heartthrob going on a world tour, and he's already had his DNA stolen by this secretive organization called The Vault, which operates anonymously. They do everything through crypto. There's no tracking or tracing them. And in this near future world, about 30 years in the future, all this stuff to do in a lab is very cheap and very DIY, which is already the trend today. It is getting much easier and more accessible to do manipulation and to have lab tools and have space, and pretty much anyone with a little training can probably get it done.
Think about a pregnancy test. I mean, there was a time when, you know, women could not easily detect early pregnancy. You had to go to the doctor or, you know, figure out what was going wrong with you. But now, you know, you can pee on a stick and, you know, there you are. So I also find it interesting, you know, that when the Alabama Supreme Court decided that IVF was not viable, that even the Alabama legislature overruled him, and, you know, passed an act just in the last few days to actually protect IVF. So you're right, it is controversial. And, you know, at the moment in particular, when we were engaged in all these culture wars, you know, people stake out a position, and it's very hard to gain easy acceptance, as you point out, of new technology or something very different. I do know, for example, that we could clone our puppy. I know people, I've read about people who've done it. It's extremely expensive, but in point of fact, we loved her a lot, and we thought about it. We really did, and then we thought, no, we would rescue new puppies, and she'd been a good dog a long time, and, you know, it's time to let her go, which is a really important part of owning pets, is that you have to remember to do that. But it was briefly tempting.
Last I heard, that cost $50,000.
That was it. Yeah. Exactly. Right. Yeah.
And the question is, would it even be the same animal? Because what's nurture versus nature? Right?
Yeah. All those things. It would have been another, another similar, but not necessarily the same, could have had a terrible disposition, and then we would have been really unhappy that we'd done it. Yeah. But that's like having children. You know, you can't guarantee that every child you have, you know, is going to be exactly the way you hoped it might be. And siblings are very different, right? I mean, if any of you come from more than one child family, you will know my brother and sister are very different from me. So, you know, there are no guarantees.
Right. And that plays into another theme of the book, the selection aspect.
Right.
So do you want me to talk a little bit about that?
Whatever you'd like to talk about. This is your book and your event. So I'm trying to convince you that this is a really good thriller. And the fact that it does deal with something slightly in the future does not make it science fiction. It really isn't. It's something that is relevant to just where we are.
Yeah. And yes.
I didn't quite get, is the science that you're talking about real? Does that exist now, or did you make that up?
So that exists in mice. It's already been proven in mice that the scientists have taken tail cells from a mouse, converted them into sperm and egg, created embryos, implanted in another surrogate mouse, and healthy mice were born who then had their own mice babies normally. And the latest step in this process, the researchers doing it are in Japan. They published in Nature last year that two male mice for the first time had conceived healthy male pups. Healthy mouse pups, I should say. So that's already well on its way.
The book is slightly ahead of the curve of where we are, but I would say that 10 years from now, probably, or maybe a little bit longer, it will be maybe as common as IVF. And as you point out, it's safer because it's not invasive.
Right. So last year, the National Academy of Sciences commissioned a working group to study this technology and issue a report to guide the government about it because they see this is coming down the pike. So the group came out with something like a 150-page report last year all about the legal implications of this, the technical aspects of it, and things that we'll have to look out for in terms of new policy around it and the scenario that I described in the book also, the celebrity scenario as it's known.
Sure. There's some actually terrific legal implications involved here, which is what if your guy, what's his name,
Trace Thorne.
Trace Thorne, right. I knew it was a double T, Trace Thorne. His DNA is harvested from, let's say, his table at Starbucks. The biosecurity guard didn't clean it up quite enough. And then somebody has his child. Now is he obliged to pay child support? You know, I mean, that really is, you know, for a long time, women who had children where the father didn't acknowledge it were at a huge economic disadvantage. And the law, you know, was altered to give a child father support as well as mother support in situations like that. But now it could become quite a different issue. Not that, I don't know, you know, what's the ethical position if you're a father that, you know, without your consent and whatever, as opposed to, you know, an intentional father. What happens there?
That's above my pay grade.
No, I'm just saying that these are the kinds
of things we'll have to
You're a bioethicist, so this is one of those questions that's going to come up.
Yeah, well, the other question would be, too, is how would you prove that it was actually a sexual act, and they did approve and, you know, basically...
It's going to be like rape, you know, because rape forever depended upon the credibility of the witness or whatever. Another issue. Think of the Pandora's box that we're opening with this. It's a huge Pandora's box.
Well, the kid could get a DNA test to match the parent.
Yeah, but what if the parent didn't consent? I mean, if it was stolen DNA.
Right. Well, that's...
As opposed to
the normal way.
Right. Yeah. Lots of things that you've got sequels.
That's the sequel, exactly. That's a spinoff.
Anyway,
we
are. No, I mean, I think as a bioethicist, there are just absolutely fascinating questions here. And then you've touched on one which I think may be the thorniest, which is selection. If you want to go back to eugenics in the 1930s and, you know, efforts to, well, we think of the Nazis, but they weren't alone in that by any means. You know, what if it goes in a direction where there's almost like a super race or super privilege group that comes out of this?
So I talk about this a lot in the book, not as some extreme scenario where like super babies are going to be born, but rather because there would be such an ease of creating embryos because you're just giving cells. So you could theoretically make hundreds of embryos per couple. It's very simple to do that. What would then logically happen next is that, and this is already happening today, each of those embryos would have a cell plucked out of it before or around the 5-day stage, which happens today, and it would be genetically screened to determine what traits and characteristics it's predisposed to. Again, that happens now. Today, you can, as a couple going through IVF, pay for whole genome sequencing of your embryos before IVF. So this is every single letter of DNA. So we have 3 billion letters of DNA, every one of us, and it's in all of our cells. And it's only in the last 2 months that the U.S. market has seen this test become available for the first time for couples to have all of those letters examined of these embryos so they can get scores. Again, today is only health related because it's so, so, so thorny and tricky and controversial. So the report that these couples will receive is only disease risks, but they can receive already now that all that raw data. And you can imagine, you know, parents can be very competitive. All parents want the best for their children. That's universal truth. If you're a parent and you've paid for all this information, would you, or not you, but somebody, want to know what else does this data say about my kids? Not just health, but am I going to pick an embryo that has a high IQ? Because that's very genetically determined. Or do I want to pick an embryo that's going to be very tall or musically inclined or extroverted or have a good sense of well-being, which also has genetic roots? There's even today a genetic link to educational attainment. That's already, it's called polygenic scoring. So there's all different genes that get examined that may have small contributions to the outcome. And they're not fate. There's a lot about this process that is uncertain, and a lot depends on the nurturing aspect and the environment aspect. But would you want to get those polygenic scores to see the likelihoods of these other types of personality issues or traits? Yeah.
What about knowing about autism, depression?
Yeah. Absolutely.
Anxiety?
Absolutely. That would all be included.
So yeah. You would try and get rid of some of these things altogether if you could.
I mean, would parents in the future, like I think of my kids growing up, my kids are young now, but in their generation, when they become parents and they're very used to technology and science and they're growing up with these things, you know, all around them, would they want to opt into more information versus just like rolling the dice genetically and saying, let's just see what happens. Maybe my kid will have a gene for cancer, maybe not, but you know, that's how we've always done it. Or will they say, wait, we now have a better way to do things so we can protect our future kids with more informed choices. So I think it straddles the line of eugenics. If you're thinking about like, I only want the kids with the good traits, that's a scary thought for all of us, I think. But it also is, I think, an understandable impulse that people would want to make sure their future kids are healthy and have the best shot at life. And again, this is not editing genes. Like there's no super baby designer, you know, manipulation of DNA in my book at all, because while that's starting to be a possibility in real life, I don't think that would ever be legal. So that's like off the table. There's a red line. You can't edit embryos. I don't think that'll ever be allowed. But I do think it's very possible that people will want more and more information genetically on the embryos that they choose to implant.
Yeah. They choose not to. They would have to choose not to choose some of them.
Right. Absolutely. There would be a lot of them that you would discard for whatever reason. Yeah.
But if you could create, you know, as you point out, dozens of embryos, you know, you wouldn't give birth to all of them. I mean, you know, people don't want to have families of 50 children or something. So
yeah.
inevitably there. But, you know, if you really want to go back to, you know, to Darwin, this is an interesting, you know, basically we are stepping into evolution is what we're really doing here. You know, it's all been left to chance. I remember when I was taking Intro to Biology at Stanford, which was, you know, 1958, one of the professors talked about the fact that we have allowed genetic variances to actually expand because, you know, we can't screen for them. I think he was talking about diabetes, for example, maybe diabetes 1, that instead of those people dying off, mm-hmm. we have interfered with insulin and whatever it is, and we're allowing the vector to go that way. Whereas in nature, people would have died and therefore not reproduced. And so we have actually interfered with modern medicine in the normal process of evolution. So how different really is what she's talking about from that?
I mean, if you carry this several generations through and you can pick not to have a diabetic child,
right,
or cancer as much as you can prevent it, you're selecting out sort of a super race kind of. You're selecting out a long-lived, healthy...
Yeah. I'm not arguing with that, and maybe you're actually improving overall the quality of the human race, which is where we're going to get into all kinds of ethical quarrels. And do you remember some years ago, there was a really terrible plane crash, a small plane crash, I think it was over east of Apache Junction, and a separated or divorced couple with four children, the father had picked them all up with his new girlfriend, and they were flying away, and the plane crashed, and they all died. And three, or was it all four of the children, were seriously disabled. I mean, mentally disabled or developmentally disabled. So this woman had four children in a row that were almost identically disabled, which was clearly going to be a genetic issue. And we only found out about it because tragically they all died. But I was trying to imagine her life, you know, if they had lived as opposed, and she was about to be a single parent of four disabled children living in a, you know, mobile home in Apache Junction. How would that have gone? So I'm not saying there are any right or wrong answers there, but if it had been me, if I'd had one, I would have been, you know, out there to find out what the possibilities are. I read a thriller today, which hinges on, at the end, a woman with Huntington's chorea, which is, you know, a completely fatal disease. And wouldn't it be wonderful if, you know, people didn't have to be born with, you know, Huntington chorea, for example?
And with Huntington's, you don't even know you have that until closer to middle age. So you could have already had kids, and then they have a 50% chance
that's
of getting
right.
it. So
do you remember that was an episode of House? It was the worst episode of House of all the houses where he insisted because his assistant, whatever her name was, her family had Huntington's chorea, and she had chosen not to find out to be tested to see if she had it, and he insisted that she did. And I was voting for her. I'd rather not have known, because what good would it do you? Since it was fatal, regardless of anything you could do, why would you want to know that?
Yeah, I mean, this reminds me, I participated in 23andMe a number of years ago. Have any of you done this test? No. So it was like 10 years ago, but you can still get it done. You spit into a tube, you send your saliva away, and they give you a report based on your traits and care and health risks. And they also ask, do you want to find out if you have the early onset Alzheimer's gene or the BRCA breast cancer genes? And I remember thinking, just like you're saying, I don't know if I want to know that I have that. There's no treatment for these things, but...
Well, but there is now. There are actually dementia staving off techniques and breast cancer, whatever it is. So I think in those two cases, I would rather know.
Yeah.
I just did that test because I had to check to see what was going on with me because I just had cancer and so on. And I wasn't a BRCA gene, but I'm a CHEK2. Mm. I have a CHEK2 gene, which then I was asked if I wanted to send out my results to my family members. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's
early detection is the entire key, you know, to the whole thing. And most of the time, that's why ovarian cancer is such a killer. It doesn't have any symptoms until it's too late to do anything about it.
So then going back to the selection process,
right.
I mean, if you have dozens of embryos and there's a few that have very high risks of cancer and a lot that don't, what are you going to choose? You know, it's pretty obvious which one you're going to choose, but it's also not enhancement. Like, it's not a super race. It's you and your partner and whatever embryos your DNA together create. Those are your only possibilities, right? It's not you injecting, like, some superhero DNA. It's You know, if my husband and I had 30 embryos created, you know, we they're only as good as our genes can be. They're not super DNA.
That's true, but the next generation might have enhanced genes, you know, which is his point. But
well, that's true. They could eventually, over time,
five
get better.
5 to 10 generations of that.
Yeah.
You select out the
That's right. That's
best
true.
That's
right. You may be improving evolution
yeah.
all the way around. However, now that we've talked about all the science, why don't we talk about what a really good thriller this is? Because you do need to know the science in order to really appreciate the action. But I was so impressed by Kira's plotting. And it has those wonderful twists at the end, you know, where you go, I didn't see that coming. So good for you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Say what you think you can say without any spoilers.
I do think going into this book somewhat blind is best because there's a lot of twists and turns and hopefully it will catch people by surprise. I can talk a little bit about the three main characters.
Sure.
So I mentioned the biosecurity guard who falls in love with the pop star. That's early in the book, so it's not a big spoiler. And that's one storyline. Then there's a young woman who's a surrogate. She's just had a successful time being a surrogate for a same-sex couple, and now she's looking for another job to do, and she takes on a new job. She's, you know, young. She's not a selected person. Her parents were not accepting of that technology, so she feels a little behind her peers who are doing, you know, big, exciting things, and she's sort of more mediocre in her abilities, so she's turned to this other career, which is its own ethical concern on its own, like, the types of people that will have to contend with this in their peer group. She ends up becoming suspicious of the man who hired her to carry his baby. So that's one storyline. And then the last one is this young aspiring journalist. She might be my favorite character because I base some of her experiences on myself. I lived in New York City in my 20s. I worked at some big magazines and newspapers, and I always felt this sense that I wanted to like make a mark and get my career going and find a scoop or, you know, do some exciting investigative reporting. And I'm not sure that I ever fully fulfilled that. I had some exciting stories, but you know, everyone in their 20s, like living in New York and being young and ambitious, wants to do something great. And so that character works. She's just landed this prestigious fellowship at a magazine that's kind of like The New Yorker, but with a tech focus, like if The New Yorker and Wired had a magazine baby. And she's looking for her first big scoop. So those are the three main characters, and they intertwine in hopefully surprising ways.
Very surprising ways. I was surprised, you know, so that's always a good sign if I am surprised. Right. I love it. Anyway, I also would like to say that Kira's prose is very elegant. You know, I mean, you can have all these other elements. And then if you're just a bad writer, who cares? You know, it's, you really, you know, want to enjoy the prose along with all the rest of it. So I give you very high marks on all of this. So, do any of you have questions about anything, since you're a writer's group, why don't you know ask your writers questions? You know, it always comes up, what's your process and all the rest of it.
Sure.
It sounds like a great book club book.
I think so.
Book clubs, and because of the science and the discussion aspect like we just had at the beginning, and then also the mystery or the suspense, if it's a thriller, it sounds really good.
I think I've been hearing
for a book club?
Absolutely. I've been hearing from a number of different people that they've selected it for their book club, and it's like prompting a lot of heated discussion, so that's good. I think
the New York Times gave it a little blurb last Sunday. I don't know if you saw it. Well, of course you did. Your publicist would have told you right away that it was there in the New York Times.
Yeah, I was very excited. Nobody knew that was coming. They don't tell you in advance.
Jim, did you have a
question?
Yes, I've got a question about evolution, which, in fact, evolution is about the past.
Mm-hmm.
That was kind of a misconception. In the 19th century, people thought evolution was moving towards something. It isn't. It's about the past. And I'm wondering about parents. How do they know they're so smart that they can choose the right things for the future? We don't know what world we're going to be living.
That's true.
Or any world, for that matter, the way it's going.
Yeah.
Right. You may need children with gills so they can breathe in the water.
Yeah. I think there's no right answer. I think people will make mistakes. I think they'll make horrible choices. There's some characters in the book that are more side characters who are the result of horrible choices their parents made, but well-meaning. I think all parents will be well-meaning, but whether they choose right or wrong for their kids' own lives is a big question. So I definitely think there's a lot of room for error with this. Yeah.
But your point is that this is looking forward rather than looking backward?
Well, the individual parents may be thinking they're doing that. I mean, if you try to come up with a super, you know, ultra linebacker.
Positive selection. There's a new phrase. I've just coined it. Positive selection. Right. I mean, yeah, I think that is tilting it.
You choose your sons to be professional football players, and then football gets outlawed because of brain injuries. So you didn't dumb thing.
So there is a character in the book who's a side character, so I can talk about it a little. It doesn't spoil anything. But in fact, her parents selected her to be a track star. And her mom was a track star who got injured and kind of wanted to live out her vicarious dreams with her kid. So she selected her for this very high percentile likelihood of being a great athlete. And this kind of minor character in the story doesn't want to be an athlete. So
you can't control
what they're going to want to do. And in fact, they're going to resent you for putting your dreams and like hopes and ambitions on them when they're their own people. Even if you know more about them.
Yeah, I was
going to say, that's true. Regular parenting.
So I think that's a big pitfall that like future parents will have to contend with, that you can only kind of have so much in terms of the way of expectation of children. Even if you know a lot about what they might be like or could be like, I think it would be, I mean, this is just my personal opinion, like incredibly dangerous and like mistaken to try to guide them to like a certain life or path. Based on that, I think that would actually be like undermining what it means to be a good parent, when you should just let your kids figure that out for themselves and not hold them to like some standard, even if you know they're going to be like a math genius or this or that. You know, they have to do that on their own.
So looking at Jim's question, or listening to Jim's question, what we also don't know is what leaps and bounds medical science is going to make in the time that we're moving towards this technology. And so to say now that there are certain things that you might like, for example, your family might not want to be tested for thyroid cancer, but by the time this technology, for example, might become more common, we don't know what medical science is going to come up with. I mean, every day, if you read about it, there's a new, what is it today? There was something about they can inject cells to do something that previously they had to do outside the body, and now they can, you know, put killer cells inside the body, and they'll go and attack whatever bad things there are.
I think you might be talking about the Wall Street Journal article about the in vivo, that's the in-the-body treatment for heart disease.
Exactly, that was it, yeah.
So I work in biotech by day. So I'm pretty familiar with a lot of the up-and-coming medical technologies. So that is where things are headed. There's incredible opportunities for gene editing and cell therapies to come in and cure, like actually use the word cure, diseases that we can't deal with.
And there's in vitro, too. You know, CRISPR going in, for example, a spina bifida baby. They can now go in and fix it before the baby is born and spare that, you know, that horrible result.
And the very first drug to actually cure sickle cell anemia was just approved by the FDA in December, which is the first CRISPR medicine. It just goes in and corrects that one mistaken letter of DNA. And these people that have been in the trial, they started in the trial several years ago, and they have not had episodes of pain from sickle cell anemia. They're considered functionally cured.
Marvelous, isn't it? Yeah.
So all the embryos in your book are in science now that are being created, no more in utero, right? This is all test tube?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they have to be able to take a cell out, cell or two out, to screen it genetically.
So that would end pregnancy as we know it.
No, so that, I should correct myself.
It could still happen, but
you absolutely need a pregnancy, whether it's you as the mother or a surrogate. They're only tested in the lab about 5 days after they're formed. They have to develop into this blastocyst, and then they have enough cells where removing one or two doesn't affect the development, then they're frozen at that stage. Okay. That's when the parents would be given reports on all the embryos they have frozen. Then they select one, it's thawed and implanted. So you absolutely need a pregnancy. There's no artificial wombs or anything like that. That technology is like 100 years away. That's much harder than this.
But yeah. Then, you know, we have a professional surrogate in this. And so that's a real question. What are the ethics of, you know, surrogacy, multiple surrogacy, you know, because pregnancy is dangerous, and as the surrogate mother's body may deplete or develop complications from repeated pregnancy, what does that do for the implanted embryo? There's endless chains of things here.
Also, Arizona factors into the book. I don't know if you caught that, but it is a storyline because this is true today. Arizona has specific laws around who's the mother in childbirth, and it's different from other states, and a lot of states have different laws about this even now, which I think is fascinating. So if you give birth to a child in California and you're a surrogate, the legal parents are the parents of that embryo, and it has to basically be done under contract, but then, you know, you as a surrogate have no parental rights. But in Arizona today, the law is if you give birth, you're the parent. So you
then you have to sign away your rights.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that's where contract law. Well, yeah. But then it's a complicated issue of contract law. You know, if you as a surrogate, even if you have parental rights, if you signed a contract and they paid for your expenses and your pregnancy and your health care and all the rest of it, then do you have to, anybody here a lawyer?
Yeah.
No. Well, I used to be. So, you know, I think about stuff like this all the time. But, yeah, I thought it was fascinating. And once again, we don't have a federal, just like, you know, the Supreme Court threw abortion back on every state. And then, totally contradicting themselves, decided that every state couldn't decide who could be on the ballot. So our justices are, you know, grabbing stuff out of the air to support whatever political theory they want, but they are not. Sorry, I don't usually get political, but I'm talking about the Supreme Court here. I just, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't say, okay, the states have, you know, you can't take Dodds and say, all right, we're throwing it to the states and every state can make its own decision. And then you can't turn around and say, okay, no state can decide who goes on their ballot. I mean, you know, it's a tremendous inconsistency. This is a terrible Supreme Court. I mean, really awful.
Yeah.
In my lifetime, easily the worst.
For sure.
I hope you're listening, any of you out there, judges. Right.
Taking notes.
Yeah, I know. So, you know, it's hard to say how a lot of these things will be decided.
Yeah. And I will say the trend today is not one very favorable to this technology in the book, because you have to be a state or a country that allows lots of embryos to be created and then discarded that aren't used. And of course, that's not really the direction that we're headed in today in recent, you know, recent years. So luckily, I took a little literary license and said, you know, the book's 30 years in the future. And I think I said in the 2030s, there was a new constitutional amendment ratified for right to reproductive autonomy for everybody in every state. And now this technology is available. So
that was a pretty wise decision.
Yeah.
Right.
Good but unless there's a policy environment that welcomes this, it'll never happen.
Right. Well, we go through swings in this country, so, you know, the pendulum will eventually swing back, or I hope it will. Patrick, did you have any questions from the audience?
Yeah, there are a couple here. Someone mentions, will ask the question, which country has almost 0% Down syndrome births? Anybody have a thought? Iceland. And apparently, yeah, she says, it terminates those who test positive at birth. Yeah, the U.S. uses different standards to measure neonatal deaths. She served on the board of directors for March of Dimes. It's a pretty interesting comment. Yeah. Other questions are just, you know, basic writing questions. You know, what are you working on now? And can you tell us a little bit about your writing schedule? Do you write every day? Do you have goals that you shoot for every day, et cetera?
So for what I'm writing now, I am still in the headspace of this book. I know I'm supposed to write a book every year. That's what my agent tells me. that's not something I am capable of doing, unfortunately. So I have to be kind of outside of this book for long enough to work on something new. And hopefully that's sooner than later. But yeah, I'll just be honest. I'm not like someone who can pump out a book like all the time. This book took me 5 years, so it was a long haul. So hopefully, yes, I'll be working on something new soon. As far as my writing process, so I like to write, I need a good 5 hour like period, 4 to 5 hour period to get really in the zone. And if I had my way and all the free time in the world, I would write from 10 to 3. Those would be my peak hours, and that would be absolutely ideal. For this book, I was able to do that for some of the time because I was between jobs for like, I think 6 months, the year that I was working on this and really getting it done, which was like 2022 into 2023. So I just like spent those 6 months fully immersed in this book. And it really needed that because the plot is so intricate and so elaborate that I needed to be in it like every day to keep up with what I was doing. And I also used this sounds very, very nerdy, but I used software that helped me plot the story. And it's called, if for any of you writers who may have like complicated storylines or timelines and you need to keep everything straight, it's called Plotter. It's P-L-O-T-T-R. And this is a brilliant writing program. It allows you to create all these different timelines for characters, and it's all color-coded, and you see everything in one kind of easy layout. And you can never do this in Microsoft Word. So this software like absolutely saved me, and I was able to be very, very detail oriented about everything in this story so that it all kind of meshed well. But then the last part of this book, for like the last 6 months of writing it, I did get a new job, and as I mentioned, I work in biotech, in communication. So I'm a PR director for a biotech company that invests in new startups developing medical breakthroughs. So I get to hear about like all these cool things people are working on and talk to the scientists and then help them get attention for their work. And so for the last 5 or 6 months of writing this book, I started writing at 8 p.m. after my kids went to bed, and then I would write till midnight and then go to bed. And it worked. It was hard, but I'm kind of a night person anyway, and I love the fact that nobody was calling me, nobody needed anything, and the house was totally quiet, and I could just get into my book. But if I had my way, I wouldn't have to start writing at 8 p.m. It's not ideal.
It will change as your children age.
Yeah.
How old are they?
2 and 7.
Oh, well, no wonder.
So, yeah.
I don't know how you did a book at all with a 2-year-old or a 1 to 2-year-old.
One. I mean, I don't know either. At 8 o'clock, that's how.
Right.
Yeah.
Anybody else have a question? Well, then thank you very much, Kira, for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you.
If you'd like to get a book signed, pardon me, I'll just move this out of the way, and you can come up and have her sign your book, and she's at photo height already, so that will make it easier. And I want to thank you Penn Women once again for coming to see us. It's always a pleasure. We will look forward to it next year. And in the meantime, as you know, we do this almost every night, actually this week, every night. So this is my 5th event since Monday, right? So feel free to come to any of our events. And if you can't come down here, you know, you can watch them on either our YouTube or Facebook. They're free. And then also, we're at almost, 271,000 podcast downloads at the moment, because all of these events get turned into not a podcast in the traditional sense, but the soundtrack becomes available to you, so you can listen to it. Have you had a chance to do that? Okay. So if you go to poisonpen.com, on the bar, one of them says events. And then if you hit it, you can see that you can go to Facebook or YouTube or podcast. And then one of our staff has his own events program designed more towards romance and women's fiction and other fun stuff. And so he has his own YouTube channel now. So we keep expanding. I love it. So much fun. It is. I know. But it's all powered by you guys. You know, we're here. I'm going to be much more powerful than you know once I can tell you about it. Right, it's going to be very exciting. Right, it's been a long time since I got to fight a legal case, so I'm looking forward to it. All right, anyway, please give Kira a round of applause. Thank you. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.